Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello and welcome to Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Dr. Kat Jarman, and today we're going to be talking about an event that took place on this very day exactly 1,228 years ago. On the 8th of June 793, a devastating attack on the Church of St. Cuthbert on Lindisfarne sent shockwaves through Europe and, so the story goes, kick-started what we now call the Viking Age. But why there? What was so special about Lindisfarne to make the heathen raiders from the north attack it? And why has this, technically not the first recorded Viking attack on England at all, been given so much attention? While this Viking raid is a familiar story to many, I want to dig a little deeper into Lindisfarne, also known as the Holy Island, to find out more about its background and what happened next. So, to tell me all about it, I've invited Dr. David Petz, a senior lecturer in archaeology from the University of Durham. Not only is David a specialist in the early medieval archaeology of Northern England, but he also leads a new research project at Lindisfarne, excavating the early medieval site to resolve some unanswered questions about its history. And we're going to be hearing exactly what he's discovered so far in a moment. So thank you so much for joining me here on Gone Medieval, David.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm really dying to hear more about your ongoing excavations and what you found so far. But I wanted to just go back to the start, really, with that event in 793, because obviously this is the anniversary of it. So I was hoping, can you tell me what exactly happened on that day in 793 and how do we know?
Well, we got no archaeological evidence that anything happened. All our evidence for the Viking attack comes from historical sources. And so you've got to remember that immediately these are sources which have been recorded by people for particular reasons. So this isn't reporting as we'd understand it, like the modern news report. So what we do know is that on June the 8th, 793, the well-established, majorly important early medieval monastic site on Holy Island is attacked by a what's described as wretched heathen men who attack the church and the wider monastic establishment. It causes kind of shockwaves across not just Britain, but it's heard about in Europe, and it's, as you say, I think it has its importance as one of the first examples of a Viking raid on Britain, and it gets its particular importance because of Lindisfarne's own significance. This is not just a random attack on a random settlement. This is an attack on the heart of Northumbrian Christendom.
So can you tell us a little bit about that context then? What was there before and why was that so important? And, you know, what's going on in Northumbria at the time?
Well, there's been a monastery on Lindisfarne since AD 635. So the monastery's been there for, you know, 150 years or so. So it's a well-established institution. The Kingdom of Northumbria in this period is one of the most powerful of the many early medieval kingdoms in Britain. Northumbria kind of sits in the middle of Britain. It's a central British kingdom, so it looks southwards to the big kingdoms of the south like Mercia, but also within its world are the Picts to the north, the Scots in western Scotland, the British kingdoms of Strathclyde. It kind of sits on a kind of cultural fault zone between the Anglo-Saxons to the south and other groups to the north. So it's an incredibly important kingdom, and Lindisfarne is the most important of its monasteries. It was founded by one of the kings of Northumbria. It retains royal patronage, and by this point it's become the focus for a major pilgrimage cult to St. Cuthbert, who was abbot there and then died and was buried and became a saint. And in this time it has acquired huge amounts of wealth. It has lots and lots of land, huge blocks of land, both in the immediate area, up into Scotland, down south of the Tyne, and it would have been probably the biggest population centre in Northumbria, certainly north of York. So it's a really important place.
So it's likely then that there are a lot of riches there that were ripe for picking for a Viking army.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You can imagine monasteries like this. Northumbria isn't a kingdom which has a huge amount of coin use, certainly not in the more northern parts of the kingdom, north of Yorkshire. But places like monasteries would have been where you found a lot of portable wealth, things you could smash and grab and carry away. So you can imagine crosses, reliquaries, shrines, covers from books, personal dress items. So we can imagine Anglo-Saxon abbots wearing gold crosses, marks of office. So there's a huge amount of material which could be taken very, very quickly. And I think importantly, somewhere like Lindisfarne would have been well known as a centre of exchange on a regional and possibly even international scale in this period. So I think the Vikings would have known what they were after, and it's clear that they deliberately targeted Lindisfarne. They knew about it before they got there.
And some of these sources now, I know, as you rightly pointed out right at the beginning, we have to take them perhaps with a pinch of salt, or at least consider why they were written down. But they do describe this as something very unexpected, something very new. And does that imply that there was no defence, that this was literally just open, that the locals would essentially not expect anyone to do something like this?
I think it's pretty clear from all the sources that it was entirely unexpected. Obviously, once the impact of Viking raiding becomes more established, I think people become more aware of the potential. But you know, you've really got to remember, this really is, apart from a kind of one other example down on the south coast of England, this was really out of the blue. There'd never really been anything like it before. So that first attack, and I think it's just that shocker that anybody would dream of, particularly attacking a monastic site. You know, early medieval Northumbria, it wasn't a peaceful place. I mean, there's plenty of conflict going on, but the idea of attacking and sacking a monastery was something qualitatively different to the other kinds of battles and warfare that was endemic in this period.
And do we know what happened afterwards? I mean, was this... obviously, it's got such significance that we know about it so a long time afterwards. But does it mean that the activity there stopped? I think some of the sources suggest that some of the monks were taken away, a slave or killed. But did it continue?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we need to remember is this is a very, very early attack. And the tempo of Viking attacks kind of increases progressively over the 9th century. And certainly for lots of sites, they're attacked by Vikings, but that doesn't deal a death blow. And we know that the monastery on Lindisfarne continues to be there. Well, the traditional story is until 875, and that is, in histories written by later monks from the same community once they were in Durham, that's the point they say that the relics of Cuthbert and the other saints were taken away from Lindisfarne. And then there's this story how the community from the monastery, they go to various other places in northern England before finally ending up in Durham in AD 995. And that's why there's a cathedral in Durham, and that's why Cuthbert's relics are in Durham. That's a direct descendant. That's the traditional story, but I think it's increasingly people are realising that even if the abbot and the relics and the main body of the monastery left, that there was a continued presence even after that date. One thing is people have been starting to re-look at the early medieval sculpture. There's quite a bit of early medieval Anglo-Saxon crosses and that kind of thing. And a lot of that, on our current understanding of the dating, seems to date after the point everyone's meant to have left, which is a bit of a challenge. And that means that there must have been people who were, first of all, people who wanted to put crosses up, people who knew how to make them, people who knew how to design them, people who were able to pay for them. So there's clearly some kind of continued focus, and there's been some really interesting reassessment of the historical sources pointing out that actually there are records of the island still being attacked, actually by Scots rather than Vikings, and people continuing to go there after the 875 date. So it's pretty clear that there's some kind of continuity on the island, and that's kind of one of the things we're trying to understand ourselves with our own excavations.
Brilliant. So thinking then about in 793, what was actually there? So obviously you said already that there's no evidence of the actual attack, so we don't have a ruined building or anything like that, which makes sense, again, if it's being reused for such a long time. But what was there? What, if you were a Viking on that raid, what would you likely have seen when you arrived by your boat?
Well, I think like a lot of early medieval monasteries, obviously the heart of the monastery would have been the churches. Big early medieval monastery would have multiple churches. So I think we can certainly imagine, well, we know that there's early medieval fabric beneath the later medieval monastery there as well. So we've got a possible earlier church beneath that, and the bits of the parish church, which are next to it, also has some probable early medieval bits in it. So certainly they'd probably see two churches in a line, which is a very Frankish, actually, way of laying out churches. There would have been lots of wooden buildings. Anglo-Saxon early medieval monasteries more generally, but not like later medieval monasteries like you might go and see, you know, with the National Trust Day Out or anything. They don't have lots of stone buildings. You don't have a formal stone cloister. Most buildings would have been wooden. The whole site would have actually just been very, very big, but with probably with fields and paddocks and agricultural areas and workshops. So in that respect, it, some ways, it wouldn't have looked massively unfamiliar. I think it's only the stone buildings which would have looked really different. And then also we can imagine stone crosses placed around the site. There would have been multiple cemeteries. We know probably two or three separate locations where there's burials. So it would have been a big, kind of multi-centred, sprawling settlement with mainly wooden buildings, but these stone churches right at the centre.
And so who was there then? Are we only talking about monks? Or if you're talking about that, you've got, you know, animals and things like that. Could there be families living there, women and children as well? Or is it purely monks?
Well, one of the things we've been excavating is a cemetery, which seems to date to this period. And it's very clear from our cemetery that the people buried in it are from a wide variety of backgrounds. We've got adult men and women, but we've got children. Now, you could be a monk at the age of seven, but we've also got babies. We've got at least two examples of women being buried with babies. So it's clear we've got a community certainly being buried in that cemetery, which represents a normal kind of social group. And one of our questions is whether these are people who also lived on the island. You know, it's big enough to have, you know, more than just the monks on the island. It's not absolutely tiny. Or whether these are people from the mainland, or whether these are pilgrims and visitors who've come across from maybe longer distances, attracted to the potential for Cuthbert's relics to perform amazing miracles. I think what's pretty clear is the monks owned so much land that there's no way they could have farmed it all themselves. So they must have had tenants who weren't monks who were working their land for them. So I'm pretty happy there would have been more than just monks there.
And going on to a bit more than your research, as you given us some tantalising clues there already. What exactly is it you're looking for? What sort of questions are you trying to answer in your current project?
Well, we started off with a very basic question of actually, where is the Anglo-Saxon monastery? I think we've always known there's a monastery on the island because Bede writes about it, and it's mentioned in early medieval documentary sources. But we were never absolutely sure where it was. It was probably where we found it, under the main village, but no one had ever really carried out any substantial excavation. So that was our basic question, just to find out where it is. And once we'd located areas of occupation of the right period, we're trying to understand what life was like. For me, I'm interested in the daily life of the monks. So I'm interested in things in the craft and the industry. We're interested in what they were eating. We're interested in how they lived. You know, what was life like on an island? So we've been, we're trying to get a sense of rather than seeing these as kind of special places with special holy people and somehow isolated from the world, I'm really interested in actually seeing how they actually embed into the wider world. That's what I think we're really after.
Okay, Tristan, you've got 50 seconds. Go.
Right, so Dan's given me a few seconds to sell the Ancients podcast. What is the Ancients, I hear you say? Well, it's like Dan's show, except just ancient history. We've got the groundbreaking new archaeological discoveries.
This seems to be the oldest known dated depiction of the animal world, as far as we can tell, anywhere in the world.
We've got the big names.
It's one of these sort of great things, Pompeii. It's kind of forever rising from the dead and from destruction.
We've got the big topics.
The man destroys 7 legions in a day. No one in history has done that.
Subscribe to the Ancients from History Hit, wherever you get your podcast from. Oh, and Russell Crowe, if you're listening, we would love to have you on the Ancients. Spread the word, people. Spread the word.
How's it? My name is Lassetti. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There, between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places, but you will be if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Have you ever wondered if the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were actually real? Or what made Alexander so great? Join me, Tristan Hughes, twice a week, every week on the Ancients from History Hit, where I'm joined by leading academics, best-selling authors, and world-class archaeologists to shine a light on some of ancient history's most fascinating questions, like who built Stonehenge and why? What are the Dead Sea Scrolls and why are they so valuable? And were the Spartan warriors really as formidable as the history books say? Join me, Tristan Hughes, twice a week, every week on the Ancients from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
And you've got some new excavations coming up later on this year, I believe?
Yes, fingers crossed. Myself and my collaborators, Dig Ventures, will be out in September. I mean, obviously, we were able to get out last year, so we were lucky. And that'll be our sixth season investigating our site. And what we've got an area, we've got the cemetery, we've already talked about that. But we've also got what's increasingly looking like an area of metalworking, quite substantial. We're still just nibbling into the edge of that. We've got remains of animal bones, so that's telling us about diet on the island. So there's a lot to unpick. And then we've got a PhD student exploring the wider landscape of the island, because that's got a big story to tell of its own.
That's really exciting. I can't wait to see the results of it. But if we go back to the sort of area around Northumbria, there's some other sites around there as well that are quite significant. Places like Bamborough, for example, is not far off. Can you tell us something about those sites as well?
Yeah, in Bamborough, a lot of people will know Bamborough through things like The Last Kingdom, and it's a very kind of famous castle. Many people, it's often used for TV films, and it sits on a really impressive rocky crag overlooking the North Sea, and you can see it straight across from Lindisfarne. It's only a couple of miles as a crow flies from Lindisfarne. And Bamborough is really important because it was a major palace, is probably the best term to use, of the kings of Northumbria. They would have had, I mean, early medieval kings were constantly moving around, so they would have had multiple homes, but this was certainly one of their major ones. And we know that Oswald, for example, who founded Lindisfarne, he was also resident at Bamborough. And that's been excavated by a fantastic research project going on for the last 10 or so years, probably a bit longer than that. And they've been also excavating stuff which is exactly contemporary with what we've been finding. And I think it's really important to understand that proximity between Lindisfarne and Bamborough, because sometimes people have the idea that because Lindisfarne's an island, is that it's all about being really remote. And actually, I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. I think actually the important relationship is the fact that you're only 4 miles away from one of the most important royal sites in Northumbria. This is a high status landscape. And this is a period where people are moving around by sea a huge amount because it's just quicker and easier than walking and or going on horseback. So jutting out into the North Sea is not jutting out into something which is deserted. You're actually jutting out into the shipping lanes. So, and I think this is probably why the Vikings know about it, because people are using the North Sea. This is a period when the North Sea trading networks are really emerging. So people would have known about it. And it's about, it's quite an ostentatious site. If they wanted remoteness, they could have found lots of other places to be remote. This is about making a statement. And you can imagine the someone like Oswald being on the palisade of his palace at Bamburgh, pointing across to his massive monastery, which he founded. So that's a really important relationship.
And this is a really interesting point that you made, actually, about all this contact and the fact that people are moving across the sea. And in the accounts and the reports, it seems very much like this is the first time these pagans come across. But are there other signs that there's contact with Scandinavians prior to 793?
It's difficult to be absolutely sure about this. I mean, one of the troubles is some of the objects, the artifacts of the North Sea world, they're not always easy to locate to a particular place. There's this kind of shared world where traders from York were meeting traders from Frisia, who were probably meeting traders from southern Scandinavia. They're all part of a shared world. So one of our nicest finds is we've got a beautiful gaming piece, a glass gaming piece, which is, I mean, whether it's from precisely before or after the Viking attacks, hard to say, but it's from broadly that period. And it's beautiful. It's got a fantastic parallel from a hill fort up in Scotland, a Pictish hill fort, and it's got great parallels from places like Dorestad in the Netherlands, another major trading centre. So you've got this kind of shared material culture, a shared material world, and Vikings would have been part of that. They, you know, it wasn't everything about being a Viking, but they were aware of these trading routes, they were aware of this world, where is all this trading going on. North Northumbria has... is generally seen as being a little bit too far north to be involved directly in it. But I find it impossible to believe that if traders from the North Sea are making their way up the Humber to go to places like York, they weren't pushing up further up the coast and exploring these places and scouting them out. You don't just randomly hit Lindisfarne by accident. You've got to know it's there, and you've got to know what it is as well. So I think there's, even if the 793 attack is the first clear emergence of that kind of Scandinavian connections, that they must have known about it. They must have been exploring those waters before they arrived.
And going back to some of those sources again that you talked about at the beginning, there's one quite intriguing one, which is these letters from Alcuin of York, who you can probably tell me more about. Now, he talks about the attack, but he's quite admonishing, and he's sort of actually using this attack as a sign from God, as a sign that he's actually punishing the Northumbrians. Could you tell me something more about that?
Yeah, I mean, early medieval historians, they don't write about current affairs or history in an objective way. That it's all about, particularly all the literature in this period is being created by monks. So they see everything in the world, all current affairs, all things happened in the past, they see that as the playing out of God's divine will or judgment. And, you know, they always see everything that happens as a basically God expressing an opinion about contemporary behaviour. So yeah, the idea that something bad happens, bad things happen for a reason. Things happen because God is angry. So you have this idea that these heathen Vikings, they're non-Christian, they're kind of culturally completely different, and that it's more than just bad luck. These attacks are driven by failures of the kings of Christendom to be good kings. And this idea of writing and complaining about the Christian kings not being good enough, it has got a long tradition. It goes back to kind of, you know, well before this period. But Alcuin's really important because he's Northumbrian. So he has his origins in Northumbria. He certainly had a career in York. But by the time of the Vikings, he has been headhunted, as it were, by Charlemagne, who is soon to be the Holy Roman Emperor. He is someone who is plugged right into the very kind of beating political heart of Europe. And the fact that what's happened in Northumbria is being transmitted to the Holy Roman Emperor and his court is really, really important. This isn't just something which happens on the edge of a known world. It's something which has profound impact on the continental mainland. And of course, soon it's very easy to forget. When we talk about the Vikings in Britain, we always tend to think of it as the kind of the Viking impact on Britain and Ireland and the North Atlantic, the Viking impact on continental Europe and, you know, France and the Low Countries was incredibly profound. So I think there's that sense that, you know, something nasty is coming our way, because this part of Europe, the Carolingian Empire, they are part of that North Sea trading world as well. So they are interested and worried about anything that might impact on it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, I think. There's this idea that it wasn't something just local, but those shockwaves that we mentioned at the beginning, because suddenly something is changing, something is stepping up, and that this is why Lindisfarne is seen as so important in that whole history of the Viking Age, I suppose. So earlier you talked about the different things that were taking place and that this was as a wider community, but I think most people think of these monasteries as very just religious affairs. But are there other things going on as well, like trade? You're saying this is a part of those trading networks. Do you have any evidence for that?
Well, yeah, we're getting increasing numbers of Northumbrian coins. So these are coins which are mainly minted down in York, which is right the other end of Northumbria, you know, so a good 100 plus miles to the south. And that's really interesting, because in these northern parts of Northumbria where we are, the only places we're finding coins are really being found, apart from Bamburgh, are monastic sites. They don't seem to be using coins out in the wider country, but coinage are being used at monasteries. So it may be that these are centres for exchange, because it's on the coast. Also, this day, it would have been probably the biggest population. So there's, you've got to imagine, lots of workshops, farming going on, processing, you know, drying corn, making beer, all sorts of things going on. It would have been a hive of activity. The number of people who would have been involved in making the Lindisfarne Gospel, for example, would have been tiny compared to the proportion of people who lived on the island and were basically spending all their time keeping themselves going and running the farms, running the estates and that kind of thing. So this is a big, bustling place of which the religious kind of core is only a small part.
I think that really sums up why this was such a likely target for the Viking raiders. First of all, they've got the information with so many people going, trade going on, as you rightly pointed out, that people would have known about it even over across in Scandinavia. And then you have the riches and all the sort of valuables in the monastery, but presumably also this political significance, the fact that you can attack a site like that must also, to some degree, have had an importance, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been right under the nose of Bamburgh. I mean, when the Vikings arrived, you can see on that bit of sea, the Bamburgh and Lindisfarne are both really important landmarks, and they knew not to attack the defended hill fort. They go straight for the monastery because they know that's where the wealth is. And I think really crucially, he said it's wealth you can carry off. You can't put 400 cows on a boat, but we can put monks, slaves was probably one of the key things they're after as much as anything. And the portable wealth, that stuff you can smash and grab and go off with very, very quickly. So yeah.
So is it quite likely that if you've got a big population there, that perhaps they took women and children slaves, other people's slaves as well?
Yeah, I mean, presumably you go for whatever you can grab. And, you know, these raids probably aren't very long, because it wouldn't have taken more than, you know, a couple of hours, and there would have been kind of reinforcements from places like Bamburgh. You go in, you grab what you can. And actually, in a sense, you don't want to destroy it all, because you want to be able to come back and raid it again. So there's actually no real motivation for just completely killing the goose that lays the golden egg. You grab what you can, and then you kind of take it away, then you come back later and start all over again.
Clearly, it was a very successful one, seeing as it was so widely reported. Now, in terms of your new excavations, just to round up, is there anything that you're really hoping that you're going to discover this year? What would your sort of dream discoveries be?
Well, the area we're looking at the moment, we've got a metalworking area, and we've got lots of metalworking slags and industrial residues and a couple of bits of crucible at the moment. So that's all very well and good. What I would really like to find are the moulds for casting things. So, you know, we don't actually have much church metalwork in Britain from monastic sites, because all the good stuff's in the graves from the west coast of Norway because the Vikings took it. But it'd be great to actually, what we do find are the moulds. So the moulds in which they pour the molten copper alloy to make the reliquaries and make the shrines and that kind of thing. So if we found those, that would make me very pleased because, you know, the shrine of something like Cuthbert would have been incredibly elaborate. The Lindisfarne Gospels would have had an elaborate book cover on it. There would have been multiple other reliquaries for all the other bits of saints which they had in the various churches there. So if we can find stuff like that, I think that's what would make me most happy.
Amazing. Well, I really hope that you do find that and then we can report back on that later in the year. And can people follow your excavations online? Do you have any sort of online presence for them?
Yes. If you Google Dig Ventures and Lindisfarne, you will find the Lindisfarne website where we have lots and lots of social media so people can follow us during our excavations in September. And also our project is crowdfunded. So if people follow that link, they find all the information about crowdfunding and how you can help us and how we can share back to you what we do on site. And hopefully by September, people will be able to actually come to the island and visit, and we're in a public part of the island, so stick your nose over and we're always happy to talk to you.
Fantastic. Well, I'm definitely coming for a visit, so that's me booked in already. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for that, David. I can't wait to hear the rest of it. It was really good to hear the context as well, so good luck with the excavations. And that was Dr. David Petz from Durham University talking about Lindisfarne on the anniversary of the Viking raid of 793. I really hope you enjoyed listening to this. I am Dr. Kat Jarman, and this has been Gone Medieval from History Hit. My co-host Matt Lewis will be back with another episode this coming Saturday. And in the meantime, please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. We have some really fantastic content coming up, so please do subscribe and share with your friends and family. And we can't wait to share the rest with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gone Medieval. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us out and you'll be doing me a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code MEDIEVAL at checkout.